Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual bike, scooter and moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you don't miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Right, Series 3, we are bringing out the big dogs. We're having fantastic guests, and today is no exception. Literally, he is the man on TV. Winter Olympics, NFL, MotoGP, Isle of Man TT. I associate Matt with motorbikes, but also, I'm very proud to say, he's my mate, Mr. Matt Roberts.
Oh, thank you, Ewan. Yeah, lovely to be with you both. Lovely to meet you as well, Pruts. Obviously, admired your work for a long time on there. On Sky and stuff. So, yeah, it's lovely to meet you. And always a pleasure to see your face, Ewan.
No, he didn't say he admired your work on a football pitch. He thinks you're all right in retirement, but as a footballer, pretty average.
I mean, you'd have to cast your mind a long time back. And speaking of that, Matt, it's lovely to have you on. And thank you very much for the kind words. They are, of course, reciprocated. But we mentioned it's about bikes. Full Chat is essentially a motorbiking podcast. But we've got to start in football. CEO of Scunthorpe United. Now, if you're a Scunthorpe United fan and you actually remember the small portion of time that I played for you, I apologise for that, just to start with. But how on earth did that come about? I mean, I know you're a mad keen football fan. I know you're a very proud Yorkshireman, even though, of course, over there in Scunny doing your thing. But where does that start and how's it going?
Long story, I guess. But first of all, before I go any further, Pruts, on that, on your spell, Phil Hoff, our club secretary, has pointed out that you still owe, I think, £55 for a red card fine. I don't know if you want to tell us about that.
I would love to say that it wasn't, but it was. And I vividly remember Brian Laws, who, of course, is a legend in those areas.
Yeah.
I came off the pitch, as I used to do when I got a red card, with my excuse ready to roll when the manager came and gave me an absolute kind of shelling. And I went with it, and he thoroughly disagreed, and I'll probably do solo. So it's on its way. I'll send you my carrier business. So sometime at the end of next season, mate, you'll get it.
We'll sort it out at the end. We'll sort it out at the end. But yeah, well, as you know, I've obviously had quite a long career now in broadcasting with bikes, with, as you said, MotoGP and superbikes and stuff. And probably a few years ago, about 6-7 years ago, I just started to sort of question whether, you know, is this all I ever want to do, kind of thing. And also there's always an element in TV, as you know, where you're dependent on other people and things can change real quick. You know, people can lose rights and it can be something completely out of your hands. And, you know, I'd always kind of, it can create a little bit of anxiety around the job, as much as I love it and I want to carry on doing it. So, you know, I just started thinking about what else could I do? What do I love? What do I enjoy? I love sport. That's why I got into it in the first place. And I inquired at my local uni in Huddersfield about doing some lecturing there or something. And they told me that I needed to go and get a master's. So I started looking at master's courses, ended up doing a master's in sport directorship, which is effectively a qualification to be a sporting director. Met some amazing people on that. And one of those people was kind of doing some kind of informal consulting for the new owners at Scunthorpe, just helping them out on a few matters, and knew that they were looking at some point to appoint a CEO. The new owners came into Scunthorpe in the mid part of 2023 or towards the end. He'd been speaking to them and he recommended me, and I went and had a conversation with them, had a look around. Did a presentation of how I saw that role could be and how my kind of experiences and strengths might fit into it. And obviously there's a lot of gaps there that I need to fill as well in terms of my experience, especially in football and a leadership role like that. But I was up for the challenge, you know, and I've always been up for a challenge. I've done a bunch of different things over the years because of that. And so it was a massive opportunity that kind of came my way, and I did everything I could to pursue it, and here I am.
Right, let's part the football chat. Let's start talking about bikes.
Yeah, sorry about the serious then.
I know, yeah. Well, we've done the serious stuff. Now let's get silly. Given, obviously, you talk about your broadcasting career, Matt, and how much bikes play a huge part of it. I mean, two things. Where does that love come from? And secondly, being able to work in that environment. Is that kind of dream job territory? The people that you interview, heroes, if you like, potentially, they become friends, everything about it, because it's so inclusive. You're there and you're part of the furniture. It looks like you have tremendous fun.
Yeah, well, we do have tremendous fun. And some of the people that I get to work with have become heroes, I suppose, yeah, to me over the years. Not so much because of what they've done on track, but you know, this sounds corny, but because of the type of people they are. You know, they're proper legends, you know, Shaky Byrne, James Hayden, James Whittam, James Tolsland, you know, like proper top guys. And yeah, I actually, as a kid, I was never really into motorbike racing. I was into football. That was, you know, I lived and breathed football all the time. It was all I was ever interested in. And when I left university, I did a degree in Spanish and I wanted to get into sports journalism. And long story short, a job came up in MotoGP with Dorna, who owned the rights to the championship. And for me, it was a foot into sports journalism. And that's basically what I wanted to do. So it could have been bikes. It could have been anything. Maybe not cricket. But anything else.
Not many Spanish people play cricket, I don't think. No, you're
that's
right,
true, yeah. Yeah, so the job was based in Barcelona. The fact I had a Spanish degree really helped me, gave me a leg up into that world. And from that point on, it became my job, it became my 9-to-5. But I think with bike racing, and this is probably true for lots of sports, but bike racing in particular, once it gets under your skin and once you start to understand the characters, the psychology of it, even the, you know, the engineering and the machinery, everything that goes into to winning, and actually the stories that get told during a race, you know, it's captivating. If you can understand the context and explain that context, then that's... yeah, you're just telling an amazing story. Every race is its own story. And it got under my skin and I loved it. And I wanted to tell that story. And I think when I started actually in MotoGP in the early 2000s, obviously Superbikes was huge in this country, but Valentino Rossi was just starting to break through as the big new star of the sport. And the focus started to turn from Superbikes and Kyle Fogarty and all of those years and Hodgie and all those boys. Over to MotoGP, and it was perfect timing for me, but also the opportunity to try and tell that story to a British audience really appealed to me. So, yeah, and like you said, the people that I connected with over those years, you know, the Casey Stoners, Jorge Lorenzo, Valentino, you know, to be close to those guys at the peak of their career. And before that, I mean, Valentino was his peak, but those other lads, they were kids, like 15-year-old when I first met them. And to see all of those stories play out and be a part of it was amazing.
Watching that must be fascinating. Obviously people listening to this will be avid bike fans. I know exactly who you're talking about, but you are talking about like the kind of Lionel Messi's of the bike world there, going, I saw them in the youth team and then they conquered the world and then they moved. That's a tremendous privilege. And the look on your face, Matt, suggests that is like there's absolutely not lost on you at all. You love it. You beam when you talk about it.
Yeah, they were really happy times for me, Pruts. You know, I got to travel the world as a young guy in my mid to late 20s. I went to all these amazing destinations with amazing people, formed like friends for life there. And even though, I mean, I've not done MotoGP now since 2013, it's over a decade since I did it. But I did 13 straight years, you know, I never missed a single race in all of that period. And it became like almost like a double life, you know, for better or for worse, actually. You guys know what it's like when you're going from event to event and you're a part of this kind of bubble. So yeah, very, very happy times, very privileged to have those relationships with very, very special people, you know, people who, yeah, achieved amazing things.
It's a crazy circus, isn't it? You know, the characters you meet, not just the riders, you know, the teams, the technicians, the team managers, you know, everyone. Yeah. It's a huge setup. But in terms of, you said, and said with a smile on your face, people like Rossi, you saw them come through the ranks. If you could point out one, who was the most talented rider you had the pleasure to watch? Because you were there for such a long time. Would it be Rossi, or is there someone else you think sticks to mind who probably is the best rider you've ever seen in the flesh?
The guy that sticks out straight away is Casey Stoner for me. I'm a little bit biased because, like I said, I got friendly with him and his dad in the early days because he was supported by Dorna. You know, they had this kind of, it was sponsored by Movistar, this initiative to bring new young riders through. A bunch of guys came through that, you know, Danny Pedrosa, Alvaro Bautista was in it, Chaz Davis, Leon Camier, you know, it's like a lot of kids came through that system. But I first met Casey when he was 15, and he was in the offices with his dad, and I took him for lunch at a local supermarket because I could speak English and obviously they couldn't speak Spanish. And I kind of formed a real bond with both of them because, like, age-wise, I was sort of just in between. And we had great crack, you know. We used to go go-karting on weekends off, and they come over to where I lived in a place called Sitges. Me and Gav, you know, you worked with you and you know really well, Gav Emmett, who's a commentator on TNT. So me and Gav used to live together, and Casey and his dad used to come over and spend weekends and stuff. And so I was always like looking out for him, but he had this insane talent, you know, and you could see it. And the thing is, you don't necessarily have to be an expert. You don't need to see every little nuance of a guy on a bike to know, like, there's certain things that stand out. So when he was 16, right, he raced in the 250cc World Championship. With that bike was way too big, really, and fast for a 16-year-old kid to be riding. But he was savage, and he went to the second round in South Africa. And Marco Melandri, who was, you know, the hot Italian prospect, Aprilia factory rider, you know, he was clear favourite for the World Championship that year, took off at the front from pole position, I think. And Casey went from the second round, just latched onto the back of him and just went like split shit for the first two laps. And he was out of control. It was like, or he was almost out of control. And eventually, I think on the second or maybe the third lap, it all went like spectacularly wrong. Massive crash. And as I said, you don't have to know exactly what you're seeing to know, right, there's a guy with an insane amount of talent. To be able to do that and to have the balls to do that in that situation was crazy. And it always surprised me that other people, especially within the sport, didn't recognize moments like that from people and give them better opportunities, because it took him a long time to relatively to get to where he needed to get to.
Yeah, people always say about he was like raw talent, but he could have carried on for a lot longer, didn't it? It was a bit strange, not strange, but, you know, when he stopped riding at the highest level, I was shocked because, you know, he didn't sort of retire because he was old and past it. He was at his peak.
He was, but do you know what was interesting? Actually, I don't know if you know this, but I ghostwrote his autobiography. And when I did that, the big question for me, I think, there were two questions, right? One, why is he so fast? What is this natural talent and where did it come from? And two, why did he retire so young at 27? And ultimately, the two things are linked together. He was so fast because that's all he ever knew as a kid. His dad put him on a motorbike when he was 11 months old, sitting him on the tank, pulling the throttle. He was racing from 4 or 5 year old, flat track every weekend. You know, he wasn't able to go and do other sports because his parents feared that he would be injured and couldn't compete. So he lived this really intense life from as soon as he could remember. And it was all about winning and performing. And, you know, it was a pretty intense life. Now, that gave him this unique skill set and determination to win that made him a world champion. But also it took its toll on him mentally. And and he burned bright, but not for that long for those reasons. Whereas someone like Valentino, of course, who, you know, you could see how much he was enjoying himself and riding for fun and with his friends and all of those kind of things, had such a long career because he was able to do that.
I mean, that's a fascinating insight into that life, because on here, Matt, we've had the pleasure of speaking to so many different competitive riders pre and kind of during the career and post-career. And it's amazing to work out the kind of mentality and characteristics it takes to do that. So, in theory, if Casey's living his life race to race to race at that particular speed, the racing part about it, maybe where the clarity comes in, the rest of the life becomes a blur, because if you're just constantly chasing miles per hour, that must be what it's like. It's such a fascinating way to look at it. And from a sporting point of view, you just look at these guys, don't you? And like you've had a front row seat to all this to be able to see it. And the real thing that comes out, a very lazy stereotype is you must be, and I've said this many times, haven't you? They must be crazy. Well, not necessarily. There's an element where you've got to be courageous. James Whitten would say the same thing, where you've got to be courageous, but it's problem solving and it's the ability to sit in somewhere and they feel comfort in potentially another person's discomfort in going at 120, 30, 140 miles an hour on two wheels.
100%. And it's about performance. And I think when you talk to T riders and stuff, you'll hear them talk about nerves on the start line, but it's not nerves of what could go wrong or injury or worse. It's nerves of what happens if I don't perform today, like any other athlete. And, you know, they take calculated risks, I guess. They know what's at stake. They have an incredible, I think those top guys, you know, people often say to me, God, they must be mad. You know, what are they like? What are they like? They must be mad. And actually, as you know, they're especially the top guys, they're intelligent, they're articulate. You know, their genius is really in their own way to be able to perform to the level that they do. And that was definitely the case with Casey. But yeah, just going back quickly to what you said about that sort of living in that space of just competing and constantly being under pressure. When I spent 2 weeks with him in Australia when we actually wrote the book, and he'd announced his retirement. In fact, he'd already retired. And we went out for lunch one day or something. We went to a sports shop, and he went in and he bought a load of like sporting stuff, like a cricket bat and tennis racket and stuff like that. And he was so excited because he'd never done any of those things before. Yeah.
That sounds like it's quite a lot of pressure on him. You know, it sounds like he was riding bikes before he could walk, literally. And I'm not in any way being disrespectful to his parents, how they brought him up. But obviously, that's a lot of pressure from a young age if your parents are pushing you in that right direction because they believe it's the right journey for you. And you can now understand why he walked away when he'd achieved what he wanted to achieve. And, you know, it's almost quite sad, isn't it, to think, you know, he tried cricket for the first time or played rugby for the first time when he was 30 or whatever it was. Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's lots of parents. I mean, we all, as parents, we all do what we think is right, don't we? We all do what we think is the right thing, and then someone else might not see it that way, I guess.
I suppose devil's advocate is, isn't it, for that type of thing? And given our backgrounds, if you don't have it's that chicken and egg type thing. If his dad doesn't push him, does he do what he does professionally? Yeah. And obviously, it's very, very hypothetical. And Matt, I'll have a take on it now with your feet in the football world of pushy parents and all what goes with that. I mean, mine were not remotely pushy. That's probably why I tried my best to try and do what I did, because my old man was in the nicest possible way, just kind of get on with it and do it properly. And if you're not doing it properly, I'm not going to drive you around. I'll drive you around if you're going to take it seriously and put everything into it, which I totally, totally get. Let's get back to that kind of where it comes from, because you talk so eloquently, Matt, there about Casey's story. But for you, I mean, were you sat on a bike at 11 months, having to go on the throttle, or was it a little bit more holistic than that? You could go to a bike as and when you wanted.
No, quite the opposite. No, I mean, my dad was a policeman, and he told me that if you ever ride a motorcycle, I won't teach you to drive. because you know he'd seen stuff and what have you, and so yeah. No, and like I said, there was no interest for me in motorbike racing as a kid at all. It just wasn't in my family. I knew of James Whittam locally because, you know, we're both from Huddersfield, and he was kind of a bit of a local celeb. I've got a good story about him in a minute. Actually, I'll tell you about how, I mean, in a roundabout way, he was my kind of way into it, into bikes, but. But yeah, I had no interest in bike racing. That came later in my interest in bikes, because obviously through the job, I then thought to myself, do you know what? If I'm going to, I started commentating on it after like 2 years of working with Dorna. And I thought, when I watch football, I feel I can tell if that person who's talking about the game has never played it before. I can just tell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to be that person. So I've got to learn to ride a motorbike, and I've got to learn all the... So I actually, to be fair, I had an idea at the time. This would be back in like 2004 or something. So all professional riders, less so now because they tend to get into mini bikes a bit sooner when they're kids. But guys like Casey came from dirt track, right? Other guys come from trial. Other guys come from mini bikes. You know, there's all sorts of different backgrounds of getting into top level racing. So I thought, all right, I'm going to learn to do each one of them. And then I'm going to write a book about the experience, and I'm going to use my contacts, and then I'm going to race at the end of it. So I had this idea to race in the BMW Boxer Cup at the time. And I started, I went and did Dougie Lampkin's trial school to learn to ride trial. I went out to America. I rode dirt track with Kenny Roberts Sr. and Randy Mamola, Jeremy McWilliams. I went to Ron Haslam's race school. I went to Ron Haslam's race school having never shifted gear on a bike before. Right? I'd not ridden one on the road. I didn't have my CBT or anything. But because I knew Ron through Leon, who was racing Grand Prix at the time, Ron said, oh, come along, it's all right. And I was like, Ron, I don't even know how to change gear. He was like, I don't matter. We'll sort you out. By the end of that day, I was on a CBR 600 going around Donington. Like, it was mental. So,
Matt, does this mean you're quite a good rider? You must be pretty capable. You've listed a number of teachers, if you like, that have showed you the way on different surfaces. I mean, you must be pretty good.
I'm all right. I'm a bit safe though, Ewan, to be honest with you. I'm less self-preservation. I think Whit described me to other people, because I've done a few of his track days and stuff, as safe but stylish. So I'll take that all day.
Take that, man. Alicia Starr.
That's the sweet spot for men of our age. Well, maybe not you, and he's a bit older. But
yeah, that is yeah, and he's definitely not safe.
If that's not a Tinder profile, I don't know what is.
Yeah, so I'd say that. I think didn't you and I ride together, Ewan, on like one of those Ducati days things?
Yeah, properly. Yeah,
the first time I met you. Yeah, like 2010 or something. Like yeah, the Ducati track there. Yeah,
I'm all right in a straight line. It's just the corners that get me. I go too fast. I feel like I'm not good enough for the bike because the modern day superbikes, they far outweigh my ability anyway. You know, and I think, oh, I'm all right at this. I look down, oh, I'm going quite quick. Oh, here comes a hairpin. You better slow down a bit. You know,
I'm the opposite. So you're getting in a straight line. I start looking at speed though, I'm seeing it creeping up. I'm like, oh shit, that's too fast. You know, but yeah, roll off. It scares me too much. But I really enjoy the corners, like. Knockhill, I like going there, and just because, you know, there's a little bit of a straight that you can, so you shit yourself for about 3 seconds, but the rest of it's all right, it's manageable, you know.
So when you go around with people like Whittam, does James try and make you a better rider, or is he just ribbing you because you're good mates? How does that work?
No, he tries. Oh yeah, 100%. He tries to make you a better rider. Yeah, of course. I can't recommend things like that highly enough. Obviously, as a friend, I'd say it about Whit anyway. But if you ride a bike on the road, no matter what your level is, or whether you ride a GS, or whether you know whatever you do, I can't recommend going and doing a track day highly enough. You know, whether it's with Ron Haslam or California Superbike School, I've done all of them, and James, because you just get to find the limits a little bit more and improve your skill. You know, it's so much safer if you know you can go into a corner. Like you said, Ewan, you know, sometimes you might be out on the road and you go into a corner, or it's something catches you out or something like that. It's like, how are you going to react to that if you don't know that actually all you need to do is lean into it a little bit more? Do you know what I mean? Use the throttle to balance the bike out a little bit so there's not too much load on the front. Whatever little things that you learn when you do these track days, it keeps you safe on the road. If you fall off on a track, I mean, most of the time you don't anyway. Mm. But at least it's that's the right place to fall off. You don't want to be falling off on the road.
Matt, given all those men that you mentioned and the people that you spent time with, and doing your test latterly, which again, I was very similar in the sense that I was older when I did it. Does that then mean that you absolutely sailed through? Was it very straightforward?
No, I didn't sail through. But what I did do was I went to BMW, and again, I was going to say before, I've been very fortunate that I've been able to do a lot of these track days and stuff. Like on favors, and you know, for free.
Hey, we'll have a bit of freeness here, don't worry.
Yeah, Ewan's the king of the freebies, mate. Do not feel shy about saying you get stuff for free. This is what
I'm talking about. Yeah, so I've been very fortunate in that way, and I know it's not cheap to do those things. But yeah, even with my bike test, BMW invited me to go down, and I did a full week down in near Merthyr Tydfil. That's where I did my test in South Wales. They had like a learning center down there. And they always, they said on that, like, oh, if you need to be here to pass your test, we'll get you to here so that you will sail through your test, but also we want you to be safe when you leave here. So it's, they have a fantastic program there, you know, the direct access course that they do. So yeah, but I can't remember if I sailed through it because I think I was still sort of, you know, still learning a little bit. And I did that back to back with the off-road school as well. I did the BMW GS.
Yeah, because they've got a big base down there, haven't they?
That's right.
A big spread where you can do, well, from the sounds of it, as you've got first-hand experience, you can do everything that's to do with bikes, really, and riding bikes.
Yeah, in the Brecon Beacons. And again, that's another thing that I'd recommend to anybody, just for bike control and all of that. Especially, obviously, if you do off-road stuff, but even if you don't, it's brilliant. It's great fun, and you learn
that's
a lot.
Just, if you can hear that ringing, that's just probably something free turning up at my front door.
So that's you passing your test and getting on board with it. So now let's move into the realms of what's in the garage. What have you got a go-to? I mean, obviously you've mentioned freebies. You could probably rock up to most places and borrow something for a little while. What's your kind of steed of choice at the moment?
So, well, at the moment I don't have anything, to be honest with you. But yeah, I have been lucky. Pretty much every manufacturer have given me a bike over the years for either a few weeks or even a couple of years, you know. Been real lucky like that. I've done a few trips, like long trips on them. I did a charity ride from London to Valencia with Danny John Jules on an cool R1,
which on a pink one. On an R1, he rides a pink one, doesn't he?
He had the pink one, and I had this like black Jorge Lorenzo kind of rep that they auctioned afterwards, I think. Yeah, and a bunch of other things I did. I'm going back about 10 years now, but I did a half marathon over in Connemara, west of Ireland. And I decided, the lads were flying over to do it. I decided to borrow a bike and ride over. So I borrowed a GS. No, not a GS. It was a Suzuki. What do they call it? It's like Big Bandit, basically, 1200. Yeah, yeah. And I was at my local coffee shop before I set off, went to get a coffee, right? And I went to get off the bike. And as I got off it, I caught my heel on the seat unit or whatever. And I hadn't put the stand down properly. So bike tipped over, I fell over, bike landed on top of me. And my thumb got trapped on the horn. I was laid on my back, the bike next to me, and the horn was just like going beep.
That's like an in-betweeners moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. So this guy gets out of his car and he walks over and he's like, "You all right, man?" I'm like, not really, can you help? So it got me up. So that stands out for all the wrong reasons. But
it's like I've fallen over and I'm attracting more attention to myself.
Yeah.
And the thing I've always found with bike horns, unless you get an aftermarket one and sort it out yourself, especially when someone's cut you up and you're like, "I'm gonna give him a right good beep here," just to tell, it's always really high pitch. No, I want something like a real grunt to really tell you off.
Yeah, for some reason they're always that. Yeah, high pitched.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and then so I've been looking. Like, the most recent one I had was a Triumph Street Triple, which is an awesome bike. But I felt a little bit embarrassed when I gave it back because I just hadn't put the miles on it because I've been so busy, you know, the last couple of years with various things, kids, and all of that. So I haven't done the miles that I would like to do. I did buy. I don't know if you spoke to Witt about his Kawasaki, these W650. Did you at all?
Well, he mentioned a hangar with lots of things in it. He mentioned a
Winnie Bago. Including an aeroplane.
Christ, starting with the aeroplane. But no, he's not. But feel free to bring us up to speed. He was a wonderful guest, as you are too, man.
So Witt's got, he's got a Kawasaki W650 that he's converted into like a scrambler. Like it looks a bit like a Triumph scrambler, like the old Steve McQueen sort of Great Escape Job type thing. And for a long time, a friend of James's had a motorbike shop in Huddersfield called Earnshaw's, and I was driving past Earnshaw's one day and I saw this bike outside. I didn't know it was Witt's at the time because it had just been done, and I drove past it and I was like, I want that bike, I'm gonna go back and buy that bike. I think I had the kids with me or something. So like the next day I went back down and I went in and I said, "You had a bike outside yesterday, an orange scrambler thing, I don't know what it was, but I want it." And the guy was like, "Oh, it's Matt, isn't it?" And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, "Well, you should know, it's Witt's bike, that." He was here yesterday. I was like, "You're fucking joking." So so I went to Witt and he said, "Oh yeah, all you need to do is you buy a Kawasaki W650, right? You can get one for about $2,000 or $3,000, half decent old one. And then what we'll do is we'll spec it." And I'm thinking, oh great, I'm going to get a wicked bike and I won't have to do any of the work here. So this was just before COVID started. So I bought this Kawasaki W650. Rode it around as it was for a little bit. It was a really nice thing, actually. And then COVID hit. I lost like pretty much all my work for that year. I just couldn't afford to do the the conversion on the bike and all of that. And I ended up, somebody came to me through Witt and went, because they're like hen's teeth, really, you know, a decent W650. So this guy came to me and offered me money for it, and I sold it. So that should be a really cool story about this custom bike fit that, you know, to all the bike listeners out there, it'll be like, oh yeah, but I'm not great at getting my hands dirty anyway. And it never happened. So that was as close as I got.
If it's meant to be, it will come back to you at some point, mate, later in life.
There's an itch I probably need to scratch at some point in the future.
Well, it'd be nice if Witt just rocked up with one done, but I mean, hopefully if he hears this might be a huge nudge in his direction. Oh, you've got a big hanger, have you? Get my bike sorted.
Clearly that was my intention. I had no intention of doing any of the work or sourcing any of the stuff. Whenever I have a problem like that, I just call him and say, "Do you know, have you ever heard of..." No, something like that. And I'm like, "Hey..." Because he's proper, he'll just go, "Right, I'll sort that out for you. Yeah, give me 5 minutes," and then it's all done. So.
It's always good to have a grown-up as a mate. I always try to surround myself with people that could... Just, if you were going to do this, what would you... I'll come and do it. Brilliant. That's exactly what I wanted. Let's stop the dance. That's the type of man that you need. Let's have a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Ewan, back to you, my friend.
I've got to ask, Matt, we've established you're a half-decent rider. We've established you're good at blagging freeness. Have you ever had to go on a MotoGP? But I was going to ask you that. You know, in the sport for such a long time, did you ever get to go on track on a weapon where you thought, firstly, no chance, I'm not going to try? Or did you have a go and go, wow, that's too much for me? Because I'd love to know the difference between a good road bike and a MotoGP bike to ride it. It must be chalk and cheese.
Yeah, I honestly, no, I've never had the opportunity to ride one. They used to do like a journalist test at the end of the year at Valencia, but they would be for your technical journalists, you know.
What about Pillion though? Because I know they used to offer up rides where you could go on the back. I mean, that frightens me even more if I'm not in control. But have you ever been on the back of a bike with someone and tapped them and said, stop, too much?
Not on track, I haven't, no.
What about Whittam? You know, your good mates with him, he must have taken you around.
No, he hasn't. No. Oh, I'll tell you who has. Ron Haslam. Have you ever been on the back with Ron?
No.
Mate. That is like, do you know what it does open your eyes to, right? You never mind like MotoGP bikes and stuff. It's like, if you take a stock Fireblade, right, with road tires on it, Ron can go around Donington at like, I don't know, he might do like a 150 or something like that around there. And you see all these track day heroes turning up with like fancy suspension, slick tires, this and that. And the reality is, the way to go faster is to improve yourself, really. Mm. Do you know what I mean? You can go to a certain speed on like a stock bike. So that's what that opened my eyes to, really, was when I went and did a lap with Ron. And he, you know, just the way that he's like, he's, when you're thinking about braking, he's still accelerating, you know, and you realize, and then the strength, the power of even stock brakes, like, you know, if they're being used properly, they're so powerful.
Yeah.
I was knackered. I was nearly falling off the back of him after two laps, because you're sort of reaching around him but holding on to like a bar on the tank, and yeah, just the effort that that goes through you know holding on, and then especially under braking where you're kind of pushing back, because at first you're thinking, oh, I want Ron to think I'm good at I know what I'm doing, so you got to lean with him, and I'm holding myself. By the end, I'm like all over his back, you know, I'm like dry humping him basically, and crying for mercy.
insane talent, though, isn't it? We spoke about modern bikes and what they can do. It's amazing. But when you get someone like Ron, you know, in charge of it, it's just, some people are born, you know. I've done the odd charity football game and I'm just thinking, oh my God, how can they do that? You know, you watch like a Usain Bolt run in the flesh, you think it's effortless. And it's the same as bike racers. It's like we said earlier, they're not crazy, they're not mad, they're just insanely talented.
I presume it's that sense of man and bike and man and machine being at one. Do you get that? You say you're between bikes at the moment, Matt, but is that what you get as well as a when you're leisurely out on a bike? It feels like home, doesn't it? You instantly go, oh right, here we go. And you can, we speak a lot to people about that ability to be able to switch off now, given the job that you've got. I'm sure it's super hectic, so that ability to kind of helmet on, bike on, whether it's a bit of music, whether it's just peace and quiet, whether it's not your phone ringing or a text going off, you can just sit and go, ah, this is it. How does that feel to you?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, yeah, like I said, that Triumph Street Triple I had was that kind of bike, because I think it's so usable and you can really ride it, if that makes sense. And it's just fun and you get into it. I had the Ducati Diavel for a bit as well. Yeah. I remember heading out on that. I had a day off. I used to have a lot of days off when I was doing the old MotoGP job. Day off in the summer, and I jumped on it. I actually rode over the tops to go and see Julian Ryder, who lives in Macclesfield. I thought that'd be a good run over from Huddersfield to Macclesfield. It's nice. You go over the tops over Home Firth and that.
Yeah, beautiful.
And I went to see Jules, and then I just kept on going. And my sister and her husband were on holiday on a barge in Wales. What's that place? You might know. It's got like, it's like a big horseshoe road. It's called Langoglen, I think it's called. They were down there anyway, and I just got on this Diavel and I just kept on riding, and I rode it for 9 hours, and I never
like the Forrest Gump of the biking world. You just kept going and going. Yeah,
I just kept going, and then the closer I got, I thought, I might as well carry on, and I'll get down to see them guys, because I was just having so much fun. I was just in a flow state, sort of thing, just enjoying myself. So, I think that's what motorcycling can do, for definitely more than driving a car. But that
would it always be a bike as a choice? Obviously, family commitments aside, nice day you need to get from A to B. Would it always be a bike that you'd go for?
The Triumph.
Yeah, no, in the sense of over a car. Obviously, you create your comforts in a car, but with a fair wind and some nice weather on your back, would you lean more towards a bike than a car?
I would do now, yeah. I think especially on a nice day, let's be honest. Mm. If it's pissing down and windy like it is today, I'd be jumping in the car for sure. But yeah, there's nothing. I mean, you just turn that journey into something pleasurable, don't you? Rather than something you have to do. So yeah, for sure.
I totally agree with that. I think, you know, you're on a bike, you're in a car, you're away, you're traveling somewhere, you know, unless you're driving some fancy supercar, which you're getting a thrill out of the bike, you can just switch off. You can just be in your own mind with your own thoughts, chill out, especially now you've got a stressful job. For me, there's nothing like it. Are you in a way, not resentful, but you wish you'd come to biking earlier because you got into it later in life, like you said, through the job, then you fell in love with it, you thought, I better know what I'm on about and start riding bike. Do you ever now wish, crikey, I wish I'd been that 17-year-old on a little 125 back in the day, or not really? Did you come into it the right way because you're more mature?
That's probably a good question. I mean, yeah, looking back, I wish I'd have done my license while I still lived in Spain. So I lived in Spain when I started that job in MotoGP. I lived there for 7 years, a place called Sitges, just down the coast from Barcelona, and beautiful roads, great weather. I should have done my test back then and should have got a motorbike back then, 100%. I don't know why I didn't, to be honest. That was the period when I was doing little bits of, you know, the riding with Randy and stuff like that. So I should have done it then. So yeah, I kind of do. I've never thought of it actually till you mentioned that. But yeah,
hit a real melancholy note now.
Sorry.
Christ, I don't want to finish on a downer.
No, I don't want to finish on a downer with regrets. But no, but I think we'll all agree there's something really special about biking.
The M62 is way nicer though, Matt. I mean, who wants to ride down the coast of Spain?
This bit of it is. Yeah, but you're right, what you said as well. But like that, that feeling of freedom and. There's a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yeah, great book.
And yeah, there's a concept in the early part of that where he sort of makes the analogy of if you're driving a car and you look out of the window, you're looking at a picture in a frame. But if you're on a motorcycle, you're part of the picture. And nice. I think that sort of sums it up like perfectly. That's how it feels, you know, when you're on a bike.
There you go, Pratt. There's my Christmas present from you, please. Next year, I'll have that book.
Yeah, you have to read it to him. You'll have to read it to him.
Cheeky, I can't read.
Can I send you back that several editions of your autobiography that you sent me? I've been trying to give them away, mate.
I noticed that's not on your shelf behind you, Pratt.
So I know.
We need to sort that out.
In fact, it'd have been amazing if I could have pulled out Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Yeah. But no, it's all diet stuff. Joe Wiggs, he's a biker. Brilliant.
Yeah.
There's your segue. Matt, I mean, it's been fascinating talking to you, mate, and not just because you're a fellow Yorkshireman. There's a natural affinity, I think, anyway. Obviously, both being born in the greatest county in England. Yeah. But just hearing your journey and what you've done and your ability to be able to adapt, to move and look ahead and potentially see what's around the corner, i.e. like biking as well, to make sure that you're ahead of what is coming. And just going back, before we ask you this last question, which is a really lovely last question that we'd like to ask all of our guests, that sense of how you are as a person, and obviously, you know, you and this is me and you meeting for the first time. It really does dovetail into what you've turned or how you've evolved in your career, because good broadcasters like yourself, engaging broadcasters like yourself, it's communication, isn't it? So given that background and given what you've done over many years live on screen, has that been able to dovetail into dealing with footballers? Does that make it any easier, that ability to communicate and people involved in the game, because Ewan mentioned what it can be like from the outside looking in, and it can be pretty brutal at times, can't it?
Yeah, I'm hoping so, Prots, because I'm kind of dependent on that, really. I think it had always worried me over the years, the more I got into, you know, because I started out, as I said, I want to be a sports journalist and I wanted to work in different sports and not just motorbike racing, but my career kind of went well down that path, and the broadcasting opportunities popped up and I took them and I did my best, you know, to make it work. And then I found myself like, shit, I'm a motorbikes presenter. Okay. Right. Well, then with that came like, but what about other stuff? And what do I do with that? I've developed a particular skill set over a long period of time, but what do I, if things go wrong or one day they don't want me or I don't want to do it anymore, what do I do with those skills? Like, it's very niche, you know? And it took probably when I started the studies and speaking to like an executive coach who helped me out through that of kind of reframing those skills and looking at ways that they can be sort of repurposed, I suppose. But like you said, it's like communication, it's building relationships, it's having empathy and understanding when I'm speaking to a rider after a race, how to approach that conversation. If I'm speaking to a retired athlete who's a pundit with me who might still be struggling with that transition, maybe, for example? How do I handle the conversations with that person? You're talking to the viewer who's at home, who you don't know, as well. So you have to do that in a different way. So yeah, you're right. So actually, that's a skill, right? Communicating with people and building relationships with people. And
I'm smiling because I've spoken to you off camera, you know, about, you know, struggles I've had in retirement and that. You're a very good man. You're a good listener. You're a good communicator. I think you're going to go down really well in the world of football. And I actually think you're quite brave to step out of your comfort zone and try something new, to reinvent yourself. So, yeah. You know, I think the skills you've learned, and I think you're doing the right thing totally. And, you know, wish you all the best for that. And, you know, I know you're going to smash it.
Yeah, thanks, Ewan. Yeah, I think there's a place for it generally, you know, but there's also skepticism as well, you know, and there's other hard things that I have to get better. I'm going to have to learn. And, you know, it's a harsh world. I just be nice to people all the time.
Good. Come on, let's ask the final question and finish on a lovely, warm, fuzzy feeling. Yeah.
To be fair, I thought Ewan was going to go down the road of, well, I spoke to you off camera before and you were horrible, which would have killed the whole Matt's a nice guy type thing. But no, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. And our final question is about the idyllic kind of mental image of you riding off into the sunset. So it's your fantasy ride, please. We want to know where you're going, who you're going to go with, what bike you're riding, and if so, and it's something that you like, what music you'd be listening to.
Bloody hell. That's a good question.
It sounds like you did the dream ride when you went to see your sister in Wales. That sounds
That's the one that sort of jumped out. I guess what I have to do is at some point get that Kawasaki W650 dream back.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I had in my head a vision of what that bike was going to look like, the color scheme. It was going to be green and gold. It was going to have a little bit of retro flat track look to it. It was going to have, you know, custom suspension exhaust and all of those things, straight bars. And I was sad that day that I had to give that up for lots of reasons. One, because I was skint, and that was why I had to give it up. So I was sad because I was skint already, but I was sad because I had to sort of give that dream up. And I guess and actually I doubt he's going to listen to this. The bloke that I sold the bike to, Rod, he was really chuffed with what he did with it, but it wasn't to my taste. So I was a bit gutted about that as well. So it'll be a Kawasaki W650. That's the dream bike, right? And Whittle will do all the work. I'll just kind of make the tees and watch him do it all.
Nice.
We'll get this like green and gold livery on it. And I will ride off in the sunset back to Ireland where my mum's family is from, where I've had a great experience riding in the past, and I'd love to do more. The roads out there in the west, in County Mayo and around there, Galway, just stunning. So, and I better take my wife with me, and she'll come.
That's the most diplomatic answer we've had, isn't it?
I think no one's Matt, you might be the first one that said about taking a better half.
Oh, really?
Hey, perhaps on a positive, that means she must listen to this podcast.
Yes, at least one listener we've got.
She won't. She definitely won't.
She's like, oh, you got the time to waffle about motorbikes, have you? God.
Yeah, I won't even tell her about it. Okay.
Unfortunately, that's about it for this week's full chat. I mean, what a wonderful way to finish. Powered by Bikeshop, as the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshop will tell her what's your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance and so much more.
A huge thanks to our special guest. I knew he was going to be absolutely brilliant, and he didn't disappoint whatsoever. The one and only awesome Matt Roberts.
Thanks, guys.
Matt, you've been wonderful. An absolute pleasure. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from, Ewan.
As ever, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you join us next time. Until then, goodbye.